From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. For my guest, Joel Cohen, he's made many movies that were a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury. This is the first time he's got to use the line in the movie. The movie is The Tragedy of Macbeth. Joel, thank you so much for being here.
Great. I'm glad to be here.
But I guess I can't help but think about this as almost this movie is this intersection of the passion of Joan of Arc and the public enemy. I mean, it feels like Dreyer and a 30s Warner crime movie to me.
Yeah, well, Dreyer was certainly a visual sort of reference point for us when we were thinking about the movie. And in another respect, from the beginning of thinking about it, we were also thinking about film noir and certain kinds of pulp fiction. It struck me at a certain point that it was interesting that this play in particular sort of prefigures a lot of 20th century tropes of American pulp fiction, a couple plotting a murder.
I mean, also the thing I find myself thinking about too in this is that you have made so many movies about marriages, you know? And this fits into that too. I mean, we think about Raising Arizona or The Man Who Wasn't There or No Country from an old man, which even that's based fundamentally around a marriage and ends with the one of the characters talking to a wife. And I just wonder what it is about marriages that's so interesting to you.
Well, I don't know that that was, I don't think that's been a sort of, it's certainly there, although how consciously there it is in the work that I've done previously with Ethan. It runs throughout it. I haven't really thought about it specifically that way, but with Macbeth, we did think about it specifically that way because it was, first of all, a project that was brought to me by my wife, Fran, and it was something that she wanted to do, and I got interested in, despite the fact that she would be playing a part that's usually played by a younger actress, which sort of ipso facto meant that the story changes a little bit, and it's about an older couple, and therefore is also, when you get into the play, becomes about a long-standing marriage. They've been together a long time. They have no children. They become sort of dynamic issues in the play. So that was a sort of conscious attempt to think about the material the way that you're talking about as a marriage.
Yeah, but I mean, it's really key to this. And I just think it's interesting, too, because it's probably the only happy marriage in all of Shakespeare, weirdly enough. They're working towards the same end, I guess I should say. But even towards that, working towards the same end, I mean, I guess I thought about this as being a kind of a natural for you, the tragedy of Macbeth, because it's so much about scheming. And it could be the kind of stuff out of James M. Cain or something like that.
Exactly. I mean, it is, in a way, it's, as I was saying before, I mean, there's, you know, it's a couple plotting a marriage. It's Double Indemnity. It's Postman Always Rings Twice. I mean, there are sort of, there are aspects of the play that feel like that. There are aspects of the play that feel like a horror film also. You know, it's the witches, the magic. There's so much of it which sort of that intersects generically with things that we've done in the past that it seems. And I think, you know, Macbeth is one of the, it's been adapted into, you know, for cinema many times just because, for that very reason, it's a relatively short play, at least as far as Shakespeare is concerned. And I think it's the shortest of the tragedies. And it's, it has all these kind of crowd-pleasing aspects of, you know, sort of balls-out entertainment.
No, it does have that. But I guess I was thinking, too, that, like you're saying, it almost lends itself to the kind of the over of almost everybody who takes it. I was thinking about, you know, the Trevor Nunn version, which is like a psychological drama, and then what Polanski does with it. And it is a piece of material that people are able to really make belong to them And I wonder if that was one of the things you found attractive to it too. Like you're saying, it is so kind of flexible in its way.
Yeah. Like all of Shakespeare, it's flexible is, I think, the right word. And I was interested in seeing or revisiting before I did this. I was interested in seeing as many of the sort of adaptations that had preceded it. Just for my own edification, that tells you what you want to do and what you don't want to do and what's been done before and what might be interesting to do. It was very different, for instance, that when we made True Grit, I didn't want to, I think I'd seen the movie as a kid, but I had no interest in going back and looking at the 1960 whatever version of True Grit. I thought that it was the wrong thing to do in terms of thinking about it. I had just the opposite feeling with this, which is I wanted to see the Trevor Nunn version with Ian McKellen and Judi Dench. I wanted to see the Polanski version again. I wanted to see the Orson Welles version again. I wanted to see Throne of Blood again. I was interested in all those things. There are things about all of those productions which are very, very interesting to me. And then things that I thought, were not interesting or were clumsy or thinking about it the wrong way or just for my own taste. And they helped me sort of refine what I wanted to do in my own head with the play.
It's interesting you say that because I find myself thinking that in all those versions you're talking about, who in a lot of ways done by people kind of at the tops of their game, you could sort of see them also wanting to bend the material to their wills. And you mentioned Throne of Blood, which is actually one of my favorite movies. I just think about the contrasts just in sort of tone between that and Polanski's, which begins with a severed limb, if I'm remembering correctly, which seems very Polanski. I mean, there's literally a blade being buried at the very beginning. So, okay, of course.
Yeah. I mean, they're such different movies. I mean, Throne of Blood is really a great movie and, made by, one of the greatest filmmakers ever. It's Macbeth and it's not Macbeth. It's Macbeth in the sense that he's doing the story. It's very, very interesting how he gets into the sort of issues of the play, but he's not doing the language. This was an attempt to, in the respect that it's a radically different enterprise, obviously, it was an attempt to foreground the language, to make that appear as much as possible and everything else to sort of hopefully support that. So a very different kind of enterprise. The Polanski movie, I think, has got really, really interesting things in it, but really struck me at the time that I went back to see it again as, as an artifact of the 70s. Does it feel dated? Not exactly. It feels very, very, very much of its time. And there are things in it that I think are fabulous. I'm a huge Polanski fan. There are things in it I think are fabulous and things that are, and looking at it, I went, well, I know that the one thing I don't want to do is do the kind of rent a castle version of Macbeth, Polanski is really, go out and have people galloping across the worst and do it in a real castle. And in a way, Polanski's version was sort of the barnyard version, the set that he used for the castle and all of that. It was the kind of down in the muck version. That was something that I was like, well, okay, interesting. Not what I'm interested in here. So it helped, focus my own thinking, looking at these things. The Trevor Nunn version, since you mentioned it, it's really fascinating. But what that is, it's essentially a kind of multi-camera recording of a stage production and a very, very simple stage production, a beautifully simple stage production. So again, something very different.
By the way, it's The Treatment. My guest is Joel Cohen, whose new film as director, his first solo film, is The Tragedy of Macbeth. The thing that dates a lot of these movies for me, and I want to talk to you about this a little bit, is the way that sound is used. I mean, the Polanski movie is really busy sound-wise, in a way that he's clearly trying to show what the medium can do in aural terms. I found myself thinking that you almost wanted to think about the movie first in the way that it sounded, just by introducing the witches as voices rather than as visual presences in the movie.
Yeah, sound is interesting. You know, to be quite honest with you, I'm trying to remember what the kind of sound design was in the Polanski. What we were after with the sound and the music in the movie is essentially the same thing we were after with the sets and the sort of visual style of the movie. And that was, we were trying to strip everything down to two or three essential elements that would repeat and would sort of echo each other. And the kind of metaphor we were using with, you know, Bruno and Stefan, the designer, and I were, was, you know, let's think about each of these things as sort of a haiku. There's, you know, three simple things, and together they sort of imply or they evoke something larger than each of those three simple elements, whether that's a visual thing or a sound thing. And so, again, the sound was like, let's talk about rhythmic things. Let's talk about dripping, pounding, bells. Let's use the sound very sparingly. Let's talk about very simple backgrounds when we're sort of cutting from scene to scene. And again, what can we do orally in the movie with effects and sound effects and music that sits below the dialogue, sits below the verse, that supports the verse, but doesn't compete with the verse? That was kind of the, I don't really know how to explain it beyond that, but that was the sort of guiding principle about sound and about also just the set design.
Again, I guess I was interested in that just because in all these versions, I think about the you know, the entrance and the opening with the witches and you choosing sort of to dispense with us seeing them and just offering that title and then us hearing those voices. I thought that was really fascinating because that makes it, to me, a lot more psychological.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. That was there from the beginning, from the little, you know, the adaptation that I did when I, in going through the play and putting down a plan on paper for the play, which was essentially the screenplay. The idea that you would not see the witches, you would only hear them at the beginning, was there for the from the beginning. But it was partly because, for a number of reasons. First of all, I knew it was going to be Catherine's voice, which is a huge thing. Secondly, I knew that I thought of it as, again, thinking about this in every sort of respect, black and white, that you had a black screen and nothing but a voice, and then you had a white screen, right, which was the fog. It's all part of the same thing. What's the sort of most fundamental simplification that you can do at the beginning of the movie? A black screen and a white screen. And out of that white screen, something starts to emerge, right? So by necessity, you weren't seeing the, I mean, thinking about that it that way, it kind of led to just a black screen with the voices, bang on a white screen, and then a bird enters, a blackbird.
To me, again, just that title and that using sound in that way, that to me almost felt, reminded me, even before we see anything of the drier version, what we're introduced to, the music and the hymnals, the sort of set the tone and the passion of Joan of Arc. And I was thinking about it just because the witch's entrance says so much in all those different movies. And to just say that, well, they're here, but this isn't about them.
Yeah.
it really does pare it down that way I was mentioning to you.
Yeah, that's interesting, actually, the idea that they're here, but it isn't about them. I mean, it is, yeah, this very interesting way to think about the play, that the, you know, the witches are a catalyzing agent for the plot. You know what I mean? It's I think to a certain extent, also, you know, they're a crowd pleaser. I mean, one of the great plays about Macbeth is it's the sort of entertainer genius of Shakespeare. You know, the fact that he was there to, he was very, very aware that he was doing this for the masses. You know, he was doing it for an audience, right? That this was all meant to entertain. Again, when you get into the weeds with all this, there are all kinds of things that lead to the witches and what Shakespeare did. I mean, he was he wrote this when James King was the King of England and had written a book about witches called Demonology. He knew who his audience was from the kind of the commoner, the hoi polloi in the audience to the king, all of whom are going to see this play. And that's interesting too. But as with, you know, all of Shakespeare, he's up to so many things. I mean, it's so you can say, yeah, it's they're there, but it's not about them. The play is about so many other things as well.
It is. And moving at a brisk pace, we will take a break. My guest is Joel Cohen, talking about his first film as solo director. The movie is The Tragedy of Macbeth. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. My guest, who's amenable to going again, is Joel Cohen. His new film as director is The Tragedy of Macbeth. It's The Treatment. I mean, I guess there's so much to talk about here with this because I found myself thinking about what your conversations with Frances McDormand, obviously your wife, must have been like after seeing her do this at Berkeley Rep. Because I found myself thinking about that because I think there's a line change in this. I may have misheard it, but there's a line change in it, and I don't want to sort of say it and give it away, about their age and in the pretty instrumental speech, and the change about children. Did I get that right?
Yeah. There's something at the center of this play, which is the fact that this is about a childless couple. And the prophecy that begins the play tells Macbeth that he is going to be king, but his children will not be kings. It's his friend Banquo whose children will be kings. This prophecy that Macbeth gets fixated on, this idea of, first of all, attaining the throne, but then secondly, the fact that his heirs won't be kings, the couple is childless, is the sort of central torment. And it's so interesting in the play because the play itself is in so many ways so much about time and the obsession with time and Macbeth's obsession in this case with what follows him, what his own legacy is and what won't be his legacy is a very interesting part of the play. So there's a line early in the play when they're plotting the murder of Duncan, when Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are plotting the murder of Duncan, where he essentially says, bring forth men, children only. I mean, she is exhorting him to kill the king, and he's responding to her exhortation and says to her almost like, you know, bring forth men, children only. You are a mother. he says that for thy undaunted mettle should bring forth nothing but males. So he's complimenting her. That's the present tense in the way it's written. But because this is, you know, about an older couple, a postmenopausal couple, and so we put that line in the past tense, right?
Yes.
I think that was probably the only, I think it's the only line that we changed in the play. And it was that little, just the sort of nudge to the past tense. There were lots of lines in the play that are cut, but that was the only line that we changed.
Well, that's why I was mentioning it. It stuck out for me because it really sort of sets into motion for us that this tragedy has begun before the play has started in this way because of the couple's age. And as you're talking about time, I was thinking about that speech, you know, with tomorrow and tomorrow, which is really a speech in this instance about all the lost opportunities. I mean, there's a third of the future being snuffed out in Macbeth and other versions, but here, because as you say, they are postmenopausal. Your phrase, not mine, by the way, that when he makes that speech about time slipping away, in effect, it becomes really kind of riveting in a way that I hadn't seen it before.
Yeah, and I think that speech is also, if you get back to what we were talking about earlier, that this is about a good relationship in the sense that they love each other, that this is a good marriage in that sense, that that not only is it a kind of, in a way, a culmination of the sort of ideas about time that run throughout the play, but it's also an elegy for his wife. And I think Denzel and Fran and I, in talking about that scene, wanted to highlight or foreground that aspect of it as well. That, you know, when this is a speech that Macbeth makes as he's looking at the dead body of his wife. So that was another element in terms of just getting back to what we were talking about before, about this idea of the marriage.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's so important here. And again, as we're saying, this foregrounded in a way that I think really makes it kind of distinctive, because as we were talking about all these different film versions and ways that people are trying to figure out how to use the medium, you think about what Welles is doing, and it's almost exuberantly stagey.
The Welles movie is really a nutty movie in a great way, but it's a nutty movie. And I really enjoyed watching it. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I think I interrupted your question.
No, I was just going to say that basically the things you're saying is exuberantly stagey. I mean, you so much are, you can feel the actors' love of being around each other. There is almost like this weird bonhomie that doesn't quite make sense in the material, but they're all plowing through it in this way. You can just sort of feel Wells' delight too, that they could almost be doing it in some weird way anything, but they're doing this.
Yeah. It feels in a strange way, the Wells movie, like a movie he made with his left hand. You know, he was out to prove something too, which was that he could make a movie quickly and on budget, and that at the time that he made it, I think he was under a lot of pressure. And there's a bit of goofing around, you know. I mean, even his accent in the play, I think he's, you know, doing this very, you know, this Scottish burr.
It's terrible.
It's all pretty funny. And yet it is interesting because, again, he is doing it. He's playing with this kind of, something I was interested in, which was this kind of line between theater and film, and something Welles was very involved with his whole life. And he does the movie all on stage sets. You know, it's fascinating for that, for sure.
But you use a lot of sets for this too, don't you? It looks that way anyway, that there are a lot of sets for this one.
Oh, no, it was all sets. This was entirely shot on sound stages. And again, that was, you know, to sort of echoing the sort of Orson Welles idea, that was the idea, you know, that we were not trying to go out like the Polanski or Dustin Kurzel version of the movie and do it up in Scotland. We wanted it to feel theatrical.
Well, it does. I mean, one of the things I told you, I chuckle a few times watching it, but, you know, as you give Denzel's Macbeth an entrance. I mean, we're watching a movie when Macbeth shows up. He even chuckled. I never heard anybody chuckle over that first line before. And I thought, well, oh, this is to let us know we're watching a movie here too.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I mean, that was the whole kind of game, wasn't it? The idea was how do we make this, how do we preserve the theater aspect, the play aspect of this, you know, this great play, but still, of course, it's the only way I can really think about it is, you know, how have every moment or every scene be specifically designed for a camera. And, you know, that's what makes it a movie. So, you know, that introduction of Macbeth coming out of the fog and walking into a close-up is obviously something only a movie can do.
Well, it is that, but it's also, I mean, I think just reminding audiences what it is, because there are so many expectations that people tend to have about seeing Shakespeare adaptations, and to just do something like that that feels like a lived moment. There's so many things that struck me, and I laughed out loud when I heard the chuckle one, because I really did think no one's ever done that before that I've ever seen. I thought that's always sort of saying, well, the movie's not about the witches, it's about Macbeth, and we're going to show you that it's about Macbeth, and he's going to walk into frame as if he's the star of the movie, because he is.
Yeah, it's it's an interesting puzzle when you put those two things together. You sort of say, are you solving this idea in the text in a movie way or in a theater way? You know, when you see the ghost of Banquo at the banquet, is that a, do you want to push this towards this sort of theatrical, or do you want to push it towards the sort of something that only a movie can do in terms of its revelation? Or, you know, or if you say, you take Birnam Wood coming to Dunsinane, which is a particularly sort of vexed thing in the play, is how do you make that, the realization of that prophecy at the end of the play, you know, palpable? How do you make it, how do you realize it on stage? And therefore, how do you do it in a movie? What does the movie let you do? Do you do it literally? Do you do it symbolically? If you're doing it visually, how can you sort of compress the visual idea into something striking, but still make it seem theatrical? Which is, I think, goes into what we were, the scene that you see in the Alley of Trees, where everyone raises the branches and the branches become like a moving river, is one thought that we had. Or the other was that when Macbeth opens the window, that the leaves blow in. And so sort of symbolically, you know, Birnam Wood is coming to Dunsinane. That's kind of a theatrical gag in a way, but it's done in such a way that hopefully, you know, it was done in such a way that it makes an impact in terms of the way it was photographed.
Well, see, when I told you before we started that I would laugh a lot, it's moments like that that are sort of playing with expectations of what theater is versus film, because I'm not trying to say this, as you put it, the funniest Shakespeare tragedy ever, but yeah, just playing with the medium in that way. And I could feel you would tickle with the idea of solving these problems in that way. Also, choosing to underline things that was about the moment of conflation of both theater and film. I really think that happens in the very last scene, which goes from sort of like theatrical to then German expressionism.
No, I mean, all those things were great fun to think about, because, you know, it's thinking about the ideas in the play, and then it's thinking about their sort of, well, for want of a better way of putting it, their sort of formal realization, you know? And as a movie maker, it's challenging, but it's also great fun to sort of look at a text that way. And I think that's kind of, look, doing Shakespeare is not something I ever planned to do. I found it intriguing when Fran brought the idea to me, but it wasn't sort of ever an ambition of mine. But when Fran suggested it, the opportunity to think about doing a movie and think about that like that, and think about those issues and those problems and what would be interesting and fun and effective to do in the context of a movie, that was all intriguing and great fun to think about.
Well, again, when I said the movie is fun, that's what I meant. And Joel, I can't thank you enough for doing this. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Elvis. It was a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to talk to you. My guest is Joel Cohen, whose first solo film as director is The Tragedy at Macbeth. It may be fun, but not for the reasons you might think. Our recording staff at KCRW includes Katie Gilchrist. Hi, Katie. John Meek, Paul Smith, and Desmond Taylor. The show is edited and produced by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.